My word. A panel game devised by Tony Shrine and Edward J. Mason. Dennis Pahl and Frank Muir challenge Anne Scott James and Dennis Norton in a game about words, with Jack Longland in the chair.
And we go straight into the first round, which tests their vocabulary. For 2 marks, can you tell me the meaning of the following words? Beginning with Dennis Norton. Dennis, yours is animadvert.
Animadvert. It sounds like one of those commercials with those chimpanzees, doesn't it? Animadvert is one of those words like vouchsafe, which is used as a kind of elegant variation of said. Mm-hmm. I've always understood it to mean he animadverted upon. So he held forth upon it, but with a touch of rebuke.
Yep, I think that's the best portmanteau description of that word that I've heard. It can, absolutely right, in 2 marks. It can mean just to observe. It can mean just to take cognizance of. It more usually has the meaning to comment critically on something or to censure it in some way or the other. 2 marks. Dennis Pahl, yours is nepenthe, which I better spell. N-E-P-E-N-T-H-E, nepenthe.
Well, it has the feeling of tranquility.
Yes.
It tranquilizes. It's concern. It's classical.
It's classical, very,
it's classical.
Yes. Yeah.
Is it a stream or a river which you crossed or drank? Or
drank.
You drank. You drank it.
Hello.
You drank the river and you felt extremely tranquil.
That's right. This is a 5th century B.C. tranquilizer. A drink, or I think it could be a drug, with a sedative kind, one that can banish grief or trouble from the mind. In fact, the Greek means not grief, which is the opposite of being grief. 2 marks. And on to Frank Muir. Frank, and this suits you terribly well, yours is a growlery, G-R-O-W-L-E-R-Y, growlery.
It's a muse, or early gathering place for a certain type of Victorian horse-drawn taxicab.
That would be a possibility, but I want...
A possibility will do me, Jack.
No, well, I'll give you a few marks.
It sounds jocular, doesn't it?
It is, yes, it is jocular.
Growlery, is it sort of House of Lords?
It could be a very small corner of the House of Lords where a disgruntled peer could sit by himself.
Oh, the loo.
No comment. If you think of the opposite of a boudoir.
Oh. A boudoir is a powdery.
Yes.
So a growlery is still, it's a den. A den, his den. It's a lord's den. Or Dennis.
I think you get 1.5 because I gave quite a lot of help. It's a small sitting room or den for the male of the species to retire to, just as a female with the vapors can retire to her boudoir, and that's why it was called a growlery. Anne Scott James, your word is a long one, dendrochronology.
Well, those long words are usually easier than the short ones, I think. It means the sounds of telling the age of trees.
Yes, in the first
instance. Which you could do by slicing them across, and then you count the number of rings they were, and if there were 50 rings, it would be 50 years old. Because most trees grow a new layer of bark every year.
Yes, I think that'll do. It has had a much more specialised sense, and I'm not going to deduct any marks. If you found a very ancient tree, or the remains of it, say, in a equally, or we hope, equally ancient temple, you can date the temple from counting the rings on the tree. And this is so that dendrochronology normally now means the fixing of dates in the past by a comparative study of the annual growth of rings in a conveniently adjacent tree.
They used to say you could tell the age of a dowager duchess by the same principle.
Okay. cutting a tree down there.
Well, before we go on to the next round, here are the quotations you've been given for the last round of all, and for Dennis Norden, yours is, people who need people are the luckiest people in the world.
He's not going to sing, is he?
I think so. Good luck. And yours, Frank Muir, is the girl I left behind me. Well, now we have a round of elementary explanations. How would you explain or describe these to a newly arrived English-speaking visitor who came from outer space? And Dennis Norden, what you've got to explain to this creature, with however many legs, is aftershave lotion.
I mean, they don't have aftershave lotion. Outer space, a technologically advanced people who can get... I would explain. I'd say, cross your legs for a moment. And the other three, yeah. that aftershave lotion is a liquid. It was an American invention that was invented in order to give some point to having invented Father's Day. In fact, it's very doubtful whether it would actually exist unless it were for Father's Day and Christmas. And you apply it to your face after you've mowed it. And if you go around any suburb, there is a kind of morning ritual incantation by which it manifests itself, which goes something like...
Two marks. The visitor from Mercury is now completely satisfied. And we go on to Liz Powell. And what you have to explain to him or another is jealousy.
Well. Can I do it in terms of a conversation?
Sure.
Difficult to explain to a green-eyed monster. Tactfully.
Good evening. I'm afraid I'm a stranger here myself. I don't know where it is. Oh, you want to know what it means? Oh, shut up, Fido. Be quiet. He's a nice gentleman. He's wearing an aerial on his head, apparently. My dog doesn't like you very much. You see, my dog suffers from jealousy. My dog doesn't like me to speak to anybody but me. Oh, that's all right, Dad. That's all right, Dad. No, be quiet. All right, yes, John, I am coming. I know I'm late for lunch. I won't be more than a minute or two. Excuse me, sir, I'm so sorry. You see, that is my husband, and he doesn't like me talking to people with horns on their heads. And therefore, that is what jealousy is, that your husband does not like you to talk to gentlemen who wear aerials instead of hats.
Such a splendid bit of dramatic invention. I'm going to mark it 3 marks out of 2. And now, Frank Muir. Frank, yours is perhaps simpler to you. A joke.
A joke? You get a lot of creatures from outer space in television studio audiences. And it might be an idea, actually, to explain... what a joke is. A joke is a story or an account of an occurrence or a conversation, normally, expressed in such words or revealing such ludicrous circumstances or such odd characterizations that in the human being it triggers off certain muscles in the face and then in the respiratory system that produces a honking noise, which is called laughter. If it doesn't produce the honking noise called laughter, your account of this occurrence is called a boring anecdote. If it does inculcate laughter, it's called a joke.
Well, can't beat that from that master of the joke, Frank Muir. 2 marks straight away. And, Scott James, yours is perhaps a little more difficult. Mm. A hiccup.
Well, you chaps, I expect that on your way from, in your rocket from Mars to Earth, you may have encountered a certain amount of turbulence. Air pockets and that sort of thing. Now, imagine an air pocket in the body. A sort of bubble of air between two ham sandwiches eaten too fast. In trying to escape, the air makes a kind of honking noise, just like the laughter which Frank's jokes produced. A sort of series of popping noises. Hick, hick, hick. That's known as hiccups.
Very succinct description. 2 marks. Well, after that bit of nonsense, we come on to a quick round of Latin cliches. For 2 marks, can you translate into English these rather overused Latinisms, which at once puts me into great difficulty.
You never get that on Radio 1. A quick round of Latin cliches. On Radio 1.
That's right. I don't know whether to use the old or the new pronunciations. I'd better use both. This finds me in great difficulties. Dennis Norden, yours is, in my pronunciation, Deus ex machina, or it might be in yours, Deus ex machina.
Never, don't you? No, we never did that. Deus ex machina is the god out of the machine, because the old Greek theatres used to have these machines above them where they lowered gods down. It's a kind of plot device whereby you arbitrarily solve all the characters' difficulties by the intervention of an outside character or person or thing which hasn't been mentioned before, like just 3 minutes before the last act, your heroine suddenly finds behind the bookcase a piece of paper that tells her she's actually the long-lost daughter of the Countess of Maltravers and the rightful heiress to Maltravers Manor.
Exactly. As Dennis quite right today, it's when humans get themselves into such a hopeless tangle that a god of some kind has to descend to sort things out.
That kind of solving of the plot at the last moment, in the late 18th century, there was an actor called Mr. Thornton, who was notorious for retrieving himself from utter disaster at the last moment. And there was a play he was in by Byron. Everything depended on him handing over the letter and then dying. And they opened the letter and all was revealed. And one night, Mr. Thornton at Windsor died without handing over the letter. And the cast stood round him wondering what to do, and they whispered, "Mr. Thornton, the letter. The letter, Mr. Thornton." Whereupon Mr. Thornton rose briskly and said, "Owing to a multiplicity of business, I had forgot to give you this." And he lay down and died, Mark II.
Deus not from the machine. Dennis Powell, yours is the next turn. Yours is Integer Vitae, or if you prefer it, Integer Vitae. I don't mind.
Well, it means whole of life, doesn't it? I mean, sort of complete of life. Visitor vitae scelerisque puris.
That's right. A little more moral sense, if I may have it.
Yes. It's a reflection on an extremely moral character.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Pure of life and free of crimes.
Absolutely right.
I'm glad to say.
Yes, this is Horace, in his most sententious. He said, "Blameless in life and clear of offence," and you get 2 marks. Frank Miller. And this is very difficult to say in either pronunciation.
Ehu
fugaces or Ehu fugaces. F-U-G-A-C-E-S with ooh at the beginning.
Labunta ani or something comes to the end. It's one of these, it's a favourite classical thing about art is long and life is fleeting and time's winged chariot is running at the back of me at some speed. Mm-hmm. It means, alas, the passing years.
Possibly. Absolutely right. And it's Horace again. Possibly. A rough translation is talking to a friend called Posthumus, who must have died after him or something. army, Posthumus, Posthumus, the fleeting years are slipping by, Ehu Fugaces. Frank Miller, 2 marks. Anne and Scott James, I think yours is a bit easier. Cui bono?
Who's that going to help?
Yes. Absolutely right. This is often referred to wrongly. It doesn't mean what is the good of this. It means who is the gainer, who's going to benefit. Cui bono? 2 marks. And we come to the last round. And to Dennis and Frank's quotations. And the marks will be awarded on the length of the applause from the audience here in the theatre. And Dennis, your quotation is, people who need people are the luckiest people in the world. I believe it comes from Barbara Streisand's song in Funny Girl.
You're much more at home with Latin cliches, aren't you?
Than
Barbara Streisand. But some time ago, and it must be a couple of years ago now, I provoked quite a storm of protest on this program by mentioning in one of these stories the fact that I have a quite, admittedly, quite illogical prejudice against people who always carry their cigarette lighters in little chamois leather pouches. Now, that statement brought forth such a flood of wounded, angry letters from listeners, so that today, here and now, I would like to take this opportunity of making a public apology for having said it. Now, having made that apology, I would now like to list some of the other kinds of people against whom I have an admittedly quite illogical prejudice. For example, have you noticed that there's a kind of man, and he always seems to be the same sort of man, who, no matter when you meet him, he's always got a small piece of elastoplast around one finger. Now, why that should immediately make me want to cross him off my list of close acquaintances, I don't know, but it just does. It's like those men who keep clicking the tops of their ballpoint pens when they're talking to you. There's no harm in it. It's just a habit. Now, it's the same with those men who quite involuntarily, I'm sure, and without even being aware they're doing it, always rub one toe cap against the inside of their other trouser leg while they're waiting for the lift. I'm not for a minute implying, you see, that these people who do that are in any way untrustworthy or perverted or lacking in finer feelings or hindering the export drive or, you know. It's just that certain people's absolutely harmless characteristics immediately lead me to categorize them quite unfairly, absolutely unjustifiably, as, well, the only word that comes to mind is yeah, or aki, inside. And it's the same with asasas. Do you know what I mean by an asasa? Because they figure very high on my list of aki people. I tell you who they are. You know when you're at a wedding or some other kind of celebratory gathering, when you all get together to sing "For He's a Jolly Good Fellow"? Well, when you get to the line, "And so say all of us," there's always a particular kind of person who chimes in, "Us, us." "And so say all of us, us, us." Do you know, I would break an arm rather than be forced into a close acquaintanceship with an asasa. Now, I know that this is possibly beginning to make me sound more and more paranoid, but it is leading somewhere. It's leading to the kind of people who are right at the top of the charts where akiness is concerned with me, and I'll tell you who they are. They are people who go in for purple loo paper. Now, don't ask me to explain why. There's no logical explanation. It's just that all my instincts rebel so powerfully against the whole thinking behind the very concept of purple loo paper that the kind of people who go out of their way to provide themselves with it are, let me put it this way, people who need purple are the ackiest people in the world.
That story is not going to do Dennis much good in Esher, and we'll pass on to Frank Muir. And if you remember, his story starts with the words, "The Girl I Left Behind Me," which I think is an 18th century song.
Isn't it? Diddle-um-pum-pum-pum, diddle-um,
diddle-um-pum-pum. You told me not to sing, didn't you?
I'm piddle-diddle-um-pumming. I'm not singing. Did I ever tell you about Brillat Savarin, the late 18th century French philosopher and gourmet, who once tied a knot in the bottom of one leg of a pair of policeman's trousers, or culotte de gendarme, filled it with top of the milk, shook it, and thereby invented culotted cream. Yes, I did. But did I tell you about the time that... I couldn't have done, because it was only last week, when my portrait was unveiled to the public in the hall of the Egham Literary Institute. It was a terribly exciting, the whole thing, really. It was a political evening, actually, an evening put on by a local political party called the Young Don't Knows. They took a while starting, actually, because they couldn't come to any decisions. Inaugural meeting. So they decided to hold this dinner. It was the one I went to. Well, it took 2 years to get the thing going. It wasn't a bad dinner to attend because they couldn't make up their minds how much to charge, so we all got in free. The meal was a bit awful. In fact, there were no vegetables at all because the young don't know who was supposed to supply the vegetables, a chap in Egham who was very proud of his kitchen garden. And in the summer, he decided to freeze supplies for this big do last week. So he experimented and went into Chilvers, the butcher's. And they've got one of these walk-in deep freeze rooms. So he took one of every vegetable in the garden into the room and stayed in with them all night with a torch to observe what happened when they froze. Of course, that when Chilvers walked in the morning, there he was frozen to the marrow. So we had no veg at all, just takeaway roast beef. But the best thing of this rather ghastly evening was the cabaret, because they decided to have a cabaret which would please the men, because it was mostly men, but also be suitable for the Egham Literary Institute. So they got a girl to do a striptease, and she was tattooed with literary emblems and things. And she was called Miss High Society, but I recognised her as Hyacinth Potter from the Ironmongers. A vast girl, I might say, you can see sort of chucking sledgehammers around on the shelves and divested herself, I mean literally, and it was a huge vest. With buttons all up here and things. It was really a ghastly sight. This huge woman, and she'd taken everything off, and there she was tattooed with books on her front. And she had a really enormous chest, and that was A Tale of Two Cities. Actually, I thought the decline and fall would have been better. And then she pirouetted in a graceful action, rather like the trans-channel ferry backing out and turning after leaving Dover Harbour. And on her back, she had portraits tattooed, literary portraits. And they started up with Thackeray and so forth. And as you went down the spine, I got terribly excited to see that the authors, whose faces were tattooed on this huge back, were tended to become local authors and more modern. And round about her vertebrae, there was Sir John Denham, who wrote Cooper's Hill, which is our local hill. And then there was suddenly Brian Forbes, Right Lumber. And then on her behind, on the right side, John Brain. And then I saw, and oh joy, oh, bringing the music, really. The girl high left behind me.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, by your vote, I find that Dennis Norden wins the story, but Dillisbauer and Frank Muir win the contest as a whole.
Taking part in My Word were Anne Scott James, Dillisbauer, Dennis Norden, and Frank Muir. The chairman was Jack Longland. The questions were compiled by Peter Moore, and the program was produced by Tony Shrine.
You've been listening to My Word from the BBC, heard each week at this time. This is the WFMT Fine Arts Network.